Guys, do you
not a natural scorer.
The honest opinion, he's not doing the job that they hired him to do.
I just disagree.
Accelerating your hockey learning curve. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. I'm joined in studio by my regular colleagues to the left, Richard Pollock. To my immediate left, Ezra Ginsberg. I say good morning to both of you gentlemen. You're looking well. How are you doing on this bright but slightly chilly Saturday, the 14th?
Before we get into any type of playoff hockey or anything like that, I have to get this beef out of the way here.
Like literally the beef on the table.
He brought a roast with him. It seems like odd to have brought a roast with you this early in the morning.
I didn't bring a roast, but I did bring Timbits, as I do every Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. I bring 10 Timbits. I usually offer Rory the first crack at it because I know that you two hyenas are going to eat all of them by the time it's about 9:30. But I get a text message 3 minutes before the show, after I've already walked in, a text message from Drew that says, "We have brownies and meringues, so don't worry about getting the Timbits unless you want to."
And you obviously wanted to because you brought the Timbits as well, in addition to the meringues and the brownies that my lovely wife Laura made for you, and for Richard.
Right, and we appreciate the fact that you brought those brownies and meringues, but what I'm saying is you could have given me a little bit more time.
Ezzy, if I had told you 3 days ago that Laura was making brownies and meringues, you still would have come with Timbits.
The reason why I'm upset is because I'm competing in the Doug Brown football media combine today, and I can't have all of these sweets in me. And if I have all of this food in front of me, I'm not even going to be able to complete the 40-yard dash. It's going to be like a 17-yard dash.
Yeah, well, I didn't play on Thursday. I wasn't feeling well, but on Thursday...
Yeah, Rich, you look terrible.
Yeah, thanks. The boys play
floor hockey.
Just kidding, you look good.
And apparently, Ezzy, you had an issue with your heart.
Well, yeah, I mean... I don't have the best diet, as you guys know. Timbits every Saturday and a lot of fast food. But once in a while, I'll throw in a salad. But I guess I made the mistake of we were playing floor hockey on Thursday night at a local school gymnasium. Uh-huh. And I started to get these shooting chest pains. And as a joke, I kind of yelled out heart attack. And a few people actually thought I was having a heart attack.
That's part of the story.
Because it's entirely conceivable that you were having a heart attack while playing floor hockey.
And it was fine. I mean, I finished the game. I actually sniped in a few goals, but it was a little bit scary. And I think it was something to do with the way I've been feeling. I've also been kind of feeling under the weather. There's something going around. It's like spring allergy season or something. But anyways, I appreciate that you brought this, but now we have way too many sweets here, and we're just going to see our BMI rise up like every week.
I don't know that we can really carry on from that opening. I'm not sure where to go from there. But let's try with Travis Hamonic of the New York Islanders. They play in Brooklyn, of course. And we know that throughout the course of the year, earlier in the year, it came out that he had requested a trade from the Islanders back home somewhere close to Winnipeg. Of course, he is from St. Malo, Manitoba. But it came out earlier in the week as the Islanders, did their final media day, their locker room cleanup day after being eliminated in the second round by the Tampa Bay Lightning, that Travis Hamonic has rescinded that trade request. The health issue that was affecting a family member of his has improved, and of course, we're happy about that. So no longer does Travis Hamonic want to be traded out of the Long Island area, back home closer to Winnipeg. Did you think that this trade was ever going to come to fruition? It had been so long since that trade request was made public, and nothing had happened. Did you really think that that trade request was going to actually come to fruition?
Yeah, I thought this summer would probably come to fruition, Drew, and cap space opens up. People think the Jets, the Jets were probably a team that the Islanders would obviously target because of the close, you know, location to St. Malo, and the fact that they have a replacement on the roster in Myers or Trouba, whoever it may be. One of those two guys, I think, is who would be to fill Hamonic's spot. But if not, Winnipeg, and you may seem that to be a kind of a wash, depending on what you think. Edmonton looked like a pretty viable option. The Oilers needing a stay-at-home defenseman, a guy in his mid-20s like Hamonic, fits the bill on a reasonable contract when they're going to have to pay a lot of these young guys big money if they haven't already. And the New York Islanders, after watching them in the playoffs and watching them throughout the season, and the fact that Okposo is a pending UFA, needing somebody, and Nielsen as well, so really Tavares is two wingers for most of the playoffs, needing a scoring winger to play with John Tavares. So that seemed like a logical fit. When with a little more cap space, a little more time, that would have probably worked. So Hamonic is now, is first off, as you mentioned, it's most important that the family member is okay. And now he's going to stay on the island, and that gives them stability. He is their best stay-at-home defenseman, in my opinion. And he is kind of the heart and soul of that roster. There's going to be some turnover there this year.
And we'll talk about that later on in the show.
And so, but I do think that there were certainly, Edmonton seemed like the most logical target this offseason. Because if you look at it, you know, Calgary's solidified there on the back end. They're pretty deep. And you look at, you know, Colorado right now having Johnson and Barry, not really fitting on that spot necessarily, although there could be a swap for one of those guys. Minnesota having a bunch of guys in the back end. Edmonton seemed like the most logical fit.
Well, first of all, if we're going to be talking about Travis Hamonic, former Brandon Wheatking, we have to congratulate the Brandon Wheatkings, Western Hockey League champions, Drew. Come on, we haven't even got into that yet.
Well, it's only 6 minutes into the show, and I thought you were still going to be talking about your heart palpitations from Thursday night. But yes, congratulations to the Brandon Wheatkings. They are the Western Hockey League champions. They defeated the Seattle Thunderbirds 8-4 last night. They win that series in five. They're off to the Memorial Cup, which starts next weekend in Red Deer, Alberta. Of course, we will preview the Memorial Cup on next Saturday's show, as we do each and every year, right before the Mem Cup gets underway.
I think they're going to win too, by the way. Travis Hamonic is an excellent defenseman. I was telling Richie during the Islanders-Panthers first round series, Nick Leddy and Travis Hamonic completely shut down the Yager-Huberto-Barkov line. Not completely, Rich, but they were out there many times. Jack Capuano put Leddy and Hamonic out there to shut down that line, and Leddy and Boychuk were paired up, and Hamonic has kind of been rotated through the top two pairings, but the point is, to Richie's point, Hamonic is their best shutdown defenseman, and Leddy and Johnny Boychuk are excellent defensemen as well. But Hamonic is a guy that all 29 other teams would love to have on their team. And it's a little bit disappointing, obviously, for Jets fans who wanted to see a Manitoba boy play on the roster. And this is exactly what the Winnipeg Jets need, is a shutdown defenseman like Travis Hamonic. I know Huss has been talking about it a lot on H&L, but Hamonic, I mean, you remember a couple years back, when Hamonic wasn't in the lineup for the Islanders, they're a different team without him.
Well, I mean, last year, the playoffs against the
last
Capitals.
Year, last year in the first round as well. Yeah. And you're talking, Hamonic's importance to the Islanders is similar to Duncan Keith's importance to the Chicago Blackhawks, Drew Doughty's importance to the LA Kings. He's that good. Remember, 2014 Olympic team, he was in contention there. He didn't make the Olympic team, but he was invited to try out for the Olympic team. And it's, as Richie mentioned, it's nice to see that, you know, his personal family issues are improving and he has rescinded that trade request.
Nice to see, especially nice to see that for Islanders general manager Garth Snow. Let me ask
Well, you know, just on that topic, Drew, I mean, he's got work to do as well with Franz Nielsen, Kyle Okposo, UFAs. He's got to figure out what he's doing with the goaltending.
And we'll talk about the Islanders when we do their post-mortem later on in the show, when we look at them and the Capitals together later on in the, I think, the third hour of today's show. Should Kevin Cheveldayoff, should Jets general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff have done more to acquire Travis Hamonic when the opportunity presented itself?
Well,
strike when the iron is hot, as the saying goes.
I don't really have an issue with that, Drew. I mean, we're assuming here that it would have cost one of Myers or Trouba. I don't think anybody's going to say, oh, it's a slam dunk. You have to make that move. Both of those are very quality defensemen. So, and if you didn't move one of those guys, then you just have a glut of right-side guys. So,
or could have been Buff Richie.
Yeah, but I mean, they just signed him as he, and Buff's in another category.
But before they signed him.
Right.
But they weren't. But the Islanders don't want to acquire an unrestricted free agent in that situation, or a pending UFA back in November.
Yeah, would he have signed that contract? So I don't have a huge issue with that, Drew. You can't just make moves based on proximity to home. And that's I'm not saying that Hamonic isn't worth a lot. I'm just saying because he's available, he doesn't necessarily fit into the roster. Doesn't mean you have to acquire.
I agree with you, Rich, and especially considering that the Jets were so far out of the playoffs leading up to the trade deadline. I don't think that was a priority for Chevy. I mean, this year the priority was signing Dustin Byfuglien, and it was about looking towards next year with bringing in
It became the priority. That wasn't the original priority.
Well, I guess early in the season, Drew, that's what you're referring to.
Well, the trade request was made public in November.
Oh, November, yeah.
So, from November, And now, Garth Snow very much, Hamonic pretty much said, I've requested the trade, but I'm not going to make waves about it. So Garth Snow, rightfully so, he had no pressing need to really make the deal, given that it seems like him and Hamonic were on a similar page throughout the course of the season. And so Snow doesn't, unless he was going to get a king's ransom, he didn't want to make the trade.
Well, not even a king's ransom, Drew. Richie just nailed it. I mean, it was most likely going to have to be Jacob Trouba or Tyler Myers. Those are your two best defensemen. With all due respect to Dustin Byfuglien as well, he's a great defenseman, but especially when you consider Trouba's age, I think Tyler Myers is better defensively than Buff. Buff is the best offensive defenseman that the Jets have. But I think when you're talking about making that trade happen, I don't think it was ever going to be very easy.
I agree. I don't think it was. I mean, it wasn't going to be a simple trade. If you want to say, okay, one for one's a simple trade, but there's a lot that goes into that.
Sure.
So,
I think it would have been a two-for-two trade, Rich. I think you have to throw in other players into that trade. I don't think the Jets would have traded either Trouba or Myers straight up for Hamonic. I just don't think that would have ever happened. But
well, that ship has sailed, so for the New York Islanders, it's certainly a good news situation in that they keep their best defensive defenseman on the roster.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue whether...
I mean, you can even look at it from the Oilers' perspective. Defenseman. So the Oilers have struck when the iron was hot there. I mean, it was pretty clearly that it was a lost year in Edmonton.
Fair enough, Drew, but this is why I talk about making a trade in the offseason, because if the Oilers are trading a winger, which they have plenty of, for Hamonic, the Islanders have to fill that defensive spot mid-season.
Sure.
Whereas in the offseason, they can take the winger and then use their time to get a defenseman to replace Hamonic. In the middle of the season, that's a lot harder to do. You don't have the avenues, you don't have free agency, you don't different things like that to fill the spot that Hamonic leaves. So if you trade defenseman for forward in the middle of the season, then you got to suddenly panic and get the defenseman. Because their defense is not good enough to trade Hamonic and not replace him. There's not enough depth there. In the offseason, you can address it in a different way.
The Islanders end up holding on to Travis Hamonic. It seems like he'll be under contract there in Brooklyn for a while, and it doesn't seem like he's going to go anywhere. So we're happy for him in that his family situation has stabilized. Let's head to break. When we return, we're going to bring in Eric Erlandson. We're going to talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning. They took a 1-0 series lead over the Penguins last night, but it was costly in that Ben Bishop and Tyler Johnson left the game. We'll talk about the Lightning coming up next on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew, Ezra, and Richard return on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
.9:15 Saturday morning here on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Bell Acres Golf and Country Club and Clear Lake Golf Course. Illegal Curve is thrilled to be presenting the 2016 Bell Acres Pro-Am on Friday, July the 8th. Play a round of golf with a golf pro and enjoy an incredible day featuring hole prizes, pre- and post-round meals, and post-round live entertainment. For more information about the Illegal Curve Bell Acres Pro-Am, contact head pro James Chapman at 204-632-8337 or visit bellacres.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the program Eric Erlandson. Eric has covered the Tampa Bay Lightning for much of the past two decades. Of course, the Lightning in the Eastern Conference Finals against the Pittsburgh Penguins. Eric, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. How are you?
Doing very well. How about yourself?
Hanging in there as best as I can.
Attaboy, we appreciate you joining us this morning. Obviously, game one last night, and we'll look back a little bit at game one, but we're going to look at the series as a whole as well, given that this is the Eastern Conference Finals. We have to start with the elephant in the Tampa Bay Lightning dressing room. That's the health of goaltender Ben Bishop. We all saw him leave the ice on the stretcher last night, a very scary incident, of course. You know, if Bishop is out of the lineup for game two or even additional games throughout the course of the series, just how significant of a loss is it? I mean, we know he was tremendous this year and that he's, you know, in the running for the Vezina Trophy. But is there a better position for the Lightning to lose a player at than goaltender, given their impressive depth?
Well, look, Ben Bishop has meant so much to this team this year. He's been such a solid, really steady presence. You know, we talk so much about how this team doesn't panic. Well, a lot of that comes from Ben Bishop, because you watch the way he plays the game. He's so calm in his crease. He doesn't let things bother him. And I think the team feeds off that a lot. Having said that, you don't want to lose Ben Bishop. And if you were to pick one player that they probably couldn't afford to lose, you might say it's him. But, you know, their backup, Andre Vasilevskiy, is not your standard backup. And we've talked, so much heading into the series about Matt Murray and what he's done to the Penguins at the age of 21 and, you know, this super prospect that he is. Well, Andre Vasilevskiy is that same sort of goaltender. He hasn't had the minor league experience that Matt Murray has, but he is a top-rated prospect, 19th overall pick in 2012. This is a very talented guy who was probably rushed to the NHL a little bit quicker than they wanted, but he's capable of handling the job. And the fact that, you know, he had to come in and start game four of the Stanley Cup final last year. You know, he's been on the stage now. This is not the first time he's been on the stage. I think he can handle it. I think the fact that, you know, what you saw out of him last night shows you that he's mentally prepared. He's certainly physically prepared. There's nobody on that team that works harder. You're going to hear it a lot. He's the first one at the rink every day, and he's the last one to leave. So he's put in the work, and he's got the mental preparedness for it. So you don't want to lose Ben Bishop. And when you have a guy like that already behind him that you're comfortable with, the drop-off might not be as significant as it seems on the surface.
You know, Eric, watching that game last night, I thought the turning point was before a goal was even scored in the game, before Alex Killorn got the first goal of the game. I thought the turning point in that game was when the Tampa Bay Lightning killed off that five-minute penalty that was given to Ryan Callahan for boarding, and the Pittsburgh Penguins didn't even really have that many quality scoring chances. What were your thoughts on that Ryan Callahan board on Chris Letang, and were you surprised that there isn't going to be a hearing scheduled with the NHL Department of Player Safety?
I'm a little surprised there's not going to be a hearing. When I first saw it, you know, anytime there's that contact with the head and then the force in which, Chris Letang was sent into the boards, you start to think that that's going to result in a disciplinary hearing. But then you listen to some of the people talk about it, and, you know, Chris Letang knows that Ryan Callahan is coming. He looks to his right. He knows he's there, and then he turns into the hit. I guess when you look at it that way and analyze it in that situation, you understand maybe that's why there's, not a hearing. But you're right. That was one of the key things that we were going to have to look for heading into the series, was Pittsburgh's power play, which has been really good, versus Tampa's penalty kill, which has been really good. Tampa's been one of the more undisciplined teams in the postseason. They put themselves in those penalty kill situations probably a little too often. But for them to kill that off so early in the game when the crowd is just amped up, to kill that off, I think is such a huge momentum builder for the team that does it.
Eric, it's obviously a serious issue that Steven Stamkos is dealing with. Do you think there's any chance we see him in this round?
You know, it's so hard for anybody to answer that question. I know Steven is optimistic, and he kind of portrayed that yesterday when he spoke. But because of what he's dealing with, you know, we know when you break a bone, we know the timeline that it would take to come back. We know when you have a bruise or a strained ligament or something like that. We know the time frame that you can come back. Well, you know, there's a reason that they call this a 1 to 3 month recovery, because you just don't know. It's all on how each individual reacts to the blunt center medication and everything that's going on. So he feels confident. He feels like he's in game shape. If he gets called on, it's just a question if the doctors are going to clear him, and nobody knows when or if that'll come.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Eric Erlandson, who's covered the Tampa Bay Lightning. Eric, Tyler Johnson leaves the game last night after taking a knee-on-knee hit from Chris Kunitz. obviously, Tyler Johnson, you know, he struggled during the regular season, but he's had a better playoffs, you know, with 13 points so far. The Lightning are already playing 11 forwards and 7D. If they lose Johnson for any length of time whatsoever, they're not going to be able to fill his shoes altogether. But how do you see John Cooper sort of rearranging the lineup to allow for that injury possibility?
Yeah, that's going to be a good one to kind of keep an eye on because, you know, you think you could pick an Eric Condra in or, you know, Mike Blunden in the lineup. But, you know, Tyler Johnson plays the top six center line. And, you know, they have some depth. A guy like Vladislav Namestnikov is able to kind of step up and be, you know, an offensive-minded center. He's been up and down the lineup. He's had some top-line minutes this year. Played, actually, he was centering Steven Stamkos for a short period of time during the regular season. So that's somebody they can kind of move up into the lineup and maybe take over that center spot. And then, you know, when they do dress 7 and 11, it, you know, those bottom two forwards, you know, it's typically not a center that's on that line. It's usually wingers. So that's probably, if that's the case and Tyler Johnson is not able to play, that, in my estimation, that's probably the way that John Cooper would go.
Eric, we got to ask you about Jonathan Drouin, and we've talked about Jonathan Drouin a lot on this show, and I imagine he's been talked about on many hockey shows for what was going on earlier in the season, especially with the AHL and all of that. But Jonathan Drouin scored a big goal last night. He's got 10 points now in this year's playoffs. I guess, Jonathan Drouin, are you surprised that he's had this big of an impact considering he didn't play much with the Lightning this year?
I'm not surprised by the impact because we always knew he's that kind of player. Like, he's a highly skilled player, you know, capable of putting forth the points and being that type of a player. You know, he just hadn't been given that role last year, and that's a big reason why he felt he wanted to be traded. You know, but he's come back. Ever since he came back from the suspension, he has been a different player. You know, even going back to when he first reported to Syracuse and, you know, talking to people down there who saw him, that he was just a much different player. And I thought Jonathan Drouin sent a important message to so many people in the first game of the playoffs against Detroit, where he was physically engaged, he was delivering hits, he was being physical around his net, he took a cross-checking penalty, you know, defending his own net. I think that told everybody that he's ready to arrive, and he's come back with a different attitude, and now we're seeing the player that everybody thought we would see when they took him third overall.
You know, Eric, there's a lot of talk this year, I think rightfully so, about Drew Doughty and Erik Karlsson and then really Brent Burns, kind of those three. Maybe you heard a little bit about Chris Letang. You didn't hear a ton about Victor Hedman, although he's certainly proven his worth in the playoffs and really in the regular season, but to less attention. How good has he been this playoffs?
He has been a beast. I don't know if there's any other way to really describe it. When he wants to take over a game, he can take over a game. He's that important of a player. And because of the way that he skates, he has that rare combination of being 6'6", but he skates like he's 5'10". And, you know, and he does it in an effortless style, you know, that's sort of that classic European skating mm-hmm. style that, you know, he just glides across the ice. So it just seems, he just doesn't wear him down for a big man. So when he can put that to use, he is so good at both ends of the ice. If he wants to carry the puck up the ice, he can do it, and he can join the rush. And then you look at a play he made last night on Alex Killorn's goal. I mean, that's such a brilliant pass. Off the boards, and he made a similar play in the Stanley Cup Final last year in Game 3, setting up Brian Callahan on a long stretch pass. So he's just so important to this team. He doesn't get the notoriety, you know, and maybe he didn't deserve to be in that conversation this year. We thought he would be with the postseason he had last year, but when players like him decide to raise their game to the next level in the postseason, you get to see how good of a player he really is.
Eric Erlandson is our guest here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're discussing the Tampa Bay Lightning. Eric, when you look at the Lightning opponent, the Penguins, you know, one of the keys to the Penguins' success has been their offensive depth, particularly that third line of Haglund, Bonino, and Kessel. They gave the Capitals mm-hmm. fits the entire series. How is John Cooper and how are the Lightning going to be able to handle the, you know, the top three scoring lines, even the fourth line of Matt Cullen, Tom Kuhnhackl, and Eric Fair when he's healthy? You know, is that a key to the series from your perspective, how the Lightning are able to handle the Penguins and their rolling four lines?
Yeah, because they are so deep in so many of those areas, you know, they are hard to match up against. And Tampa has a confidence in their four lines, you know, to kind of match up against whoever. You know, the concern for me on Tampa's end is the defensemen that go out there. I mean, Victor Hedman can only play so many minutes. He can only play so many roles. He can't match up against everybody. So it's dependent upon Tampa's other defensemen, especially the bottom pairing. And last night it was Slater Fuku and Matt Carl. You know, what are they going to do on the ice against, you know, some of those players? You know, even if you're matched up against the so-called third line, you know, how do you match up against that? You know, a key to me is what's going to go on with Anton Strahlman. If Anton Strahlman can make his way back, and he's been out now for 7 weeks, yesterday was a 7-week mark since he fractured his fibula. If he finds a way to get back into this series, that changes the dynamic a little bit, I think, in terms of what he can do and how important of a player he is. So if he comes back, I think that helps the matchup situation in Tampa, at least on the back end, and who they want to match defensive-wise up against those lines.
Eric, you mentioned Anton Strahlman, and it's really incredible that the Lightning have got this far and winning both of their both of their series in five games. How early do you think we could expect Strahlman to be back? And if Strahlman does come back, as you mentioned, do you think that the Lightning then go back to six defensemen and 12 forwards?
I think that we are going to see him in this series. The fact that he is back skating in full practices, he's been cleared for contact. I think what it comes down to now is a comfort level for him. When does he feel comfortable out on the ice taking some of that contact in a game situation? The fact that there's 2 days off here between games one and two might, you know, buy that extra day, and maybe we might see him on Monday. When he comes back, though, you know, they've had such success with 7-11. I would almost see that they would stick with it, and then you could really kind of pick your matchups maybe a little bit better. Because, you know, Braden Coburn's been so good with Victor Hedman on the right side. You know, and Anton Strahlman's been Victor Hedman's partner for most of the past two seasons. I wouldn't be surprised if they keep Coburn with Hedman and spread it out a little bit, put Strahlman with somebody else.
Final question for you, Eric. It seems like, you know, John Cooper we know he's a really good coach, but he seems like he's done a real good job with this team. With all the adversity they've faced this year, the injuries, the off-ice distractions, how would you grade him so far in the job he's done this year?
You know, I give him a lot of credit because this is a guy who his entire coaching career, he's not used to losing. He doesn't know what it means to not have success. And that goes beyond just the championship. Even the teams that he's coached that haven't, you know, won championships have been competitive and they've made the playoffs. Like, he's never missed the playoffs since he joined the USHL. You know, even going back to the North American Hockey League, he's never missed the playoffs. First half of this season, this team was not having success. Mm-hmm. They were stumbling along. They would win one, they would lose two, they would lose two, they would win three. I mean, there was no consistency whatsoever in what was going on. He found a way to keep everybody together through all the injuries, through all the inconsistencies. And again, you know, you talk so much about how teams will take on the personality of their coach. Well, if you watch him behind the bench, very rarely does he show a lot of emotion, no matter what's going on in the game. I think the team reads off that as well, just as they do Ben Bishop. And when that happens, everybody just stays calm, goes out and does their job. And that's how they've been able to kind of get to this point, you know, with all the injuries heading into the playoffs. So he's like, you know what? Well, this guy can do the job. Let's just go forward. And that's how they've approached it.
Eric Erlandson covers the Tampa Bay Lightning. Eric, really appreciate your time this morning. I know you got a kid's soccer game to get to coaching, so we'll let you get to that, and hopefully they have as much success on the field as the Lightning had on the ice last night. Thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it.
Take care, Eric. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Curry shot by Hagman. It goes off a body and in! It's over! The Penguins, Nick Bonino, may have touched it! And the Penguins have won this game in overtime! At the 6:32 mark, and ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has just left the building, and all the President's Trophy men couldn't put Humpty together again.
That from Game 6, Mike Lang on the Penguins radio broadcast. The Penguins defeat the Capitals 4-2. They move into the Eastern Conference Finals, of course, which began last night. A 3-1 defeat at the hands of the Lightning. The Lightning had dispatched the New York Islanders in 5 games. That series seems like it ended about 3 weeks ago at this point in time. So the Lightning and the Penguins are your Eastern Conference final. It's 1-0 for the Lightning in a, has to be a bit of a demoralizing loss, I would suspect, for the Penguins. You know, that game was almost there for the taking if you look at it. They get that 5-minute major early on in the game. They're not able to capitalize. The Lightning lose Ben Bishop, you know, in the game as well. He's stretchered off the ice. Yet the Lightning, you know, team that has handled adversity all season long, score 3 unanswered goals. They jump out to an early 3-0 lead. Hornqvist makes a 3-1, but the Lightning hold on for that 3-1 victory and take a 1-0 series lead over the Penguins. You know, would you agree with that, that would loss last night, guys? Would you agree with that would be a demoralizing loss for the Pittsburgh Penguins? Or is it too soon and too early, just one game into the series, to say something along those lines?
Well, it depends what degree of demoralizing you're talking about, right, guys? Because I think whenever you lose game one at home, it's demoralizing, and especially when you have the number one goaltender and arguably their best forward leave the game, you'd think that, you know, that should have been your game to take, right? When you throw in that combination of things. But got to give the Tampa Bay Lightning credit. I thought they played an excellent road game, Drew. And at times, the Pittsburgh Penguins, especially in the second half of the game, were taking over the game. And I thought Evgeny Malkin, his line, was the best line for the Pittsburgh Penguins. And I think he ended up with something like 20 scoring chances. Malkin, Kunitz, and Brian Rust, that was the best line for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Speaking of, you know, the quote-unquote third line, because the Bonino, Hagelin, Kessel line is essentially their second line now. So it's incredible that we're talking about Malkin as a third-line center. On most teams, he'd be a first-line center.
Malkin had 17 shot attempts last night.
There you go. So yeah, he was really good, but give Andrei Vasilevskiy credit. He might only be 21 years old, but you know what? Matt Murray's only 21 years old. Mm-hmm. Vasilevskiy comes in the first period, does an excellent job, only lets in one goal, and I thought that the Tampa Bay Lightning kind of almost rallied around the fact that Bishop was out, and then later in the game that Tyler Johnson was out. So you were playing with 10 forwards there for a time there in the third period, right? Mm-hmm. So it was very impressive. You know, we just talked to Eric Erlandson. This Pittsburgh Penguins power play was firing on all cylinders heading into this series. That 5-minute man advantage that they had when they didn't really generate a lot of offense, I thought was the key in the game. Yeah. And really, you know, Pittsburgh might have put 35 shots up on the board, but I didn't think they had more than a few good scoring chances. I thought for the most part, Tampa Bay Lightning used their 7 defensemen, kept everything pretty simple, kept everything from the outside. I didn't think Sidney Crosby was a factor for much of the game. In fact, Sidney Crosby, Rich, towards the end of the game, you saw him going at Brian Boyle at the faceoff circle when Brian Boyle was matched up against Sidney Crosby. And when you see Crosby get into that physical stuff, especially before and after the whistle, you know he's a little bit off of his game. So it's only one game, Drew. I think this series is going to go to minimum 6 games, especially with the uncertainty of Ben Bishop's health and Tyler Johnson's health, Rich, and when Anton Stralman's coming back. This Pittsburgh Penguins team is very fast, very talented. They're the hottest team in the NHL since January. So I definitely don't think that the Tampa Bay Lightning are going to run away with this series. But certainly it's a great start to get that first win on the road.
You better not. You picked the Penguins to win.
No, I didn't.
No, he didn't.
You pick
both of your predictions. Richie, you have the Penguins in 6.
Yeah.
Ezzy has the Lightning in 6.
Well, you texted me last night after that injury.
Well, no. When Bishop went out, I texted you as a joke that I was switching my pick. But
Okay. Oh,
so that was a joke, though?
Before the season started, I picked the Lightning to win the cup.
And then you bailed. I did that last year in Chicago, and I changed in the middle. It was stupid.
Shouldn't change.
So I didn't change this year. Now both my teams are out. But anyhow, I don't think it's too, you know, Drew, it's one game. There's an adjustment to playing. First of all, there's an emotional adjustment. Tampa doesn't get Pittsburgh as worked up as Washington did.
Sure.
There's Ovechkin. There's the history there. There's Orpik and Niskanen on the other team. There's many storylines there. There's the best team in the league by a ton of points that you've dethroned. And you've taken them out. You've taken them out. So you go to play Tampa now without those two big players. You know they're a good team. But they're not going to be a team that engages you last night, notwithstanding, usually engages you physically oftentimes. Mm-hmm. They're more of a skill squad. So you have to adjust to that playing style. It's one game. You have to see what they're doing. You'll come back and you'll make some changes. Of course, if you lose the next game, it's a different story. But I think it's just one game, and I wouldn't be too panicked about it.
Thoughts on the Callahan hit on Letang? You know, no hearing, as you mentioned in the interview with Eric. Your thoughts on the hit, your thoughts on the fact there's no hearing, your thoughts on the fact that Callahan got the five-minute major.
This is a lot of thoughts here.
I know. It's asking a lot of you. Your thoughts on the fact that Callahan got the five-minute major but didn't get a game misconduct.
Well, first of all, I'm a big Ryan Callahan fan, dating back to his days.
Ryan Callahan fan. He hasn't been relevant in years.
I've always liked the way he plays.
I honestly want to know which NHL player you're not a big fan of, because that list is a lot shorter than the other
list. You are a big fan.
I'm not a big fan of Drouin, but Drouin has
or
been...
Drew.
Or Drew. I thought you were going with Drew.
I'm
there.
A big fan of yours, Drew, but you, I have to give Drouin credit. He's been brother. Amazing in the playoffs, and he seems to have improved his attitude. I mean, earlier in the season, he was pouting because he was sent down to the AHL, but I got to give Drouin credit. I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong, right? So when you're talking about Callahan, though, Rich, he's always been a guy who plays with a little bit of an edge, but he is by no means a dirty player. I mean, Callahan's the type of guy that's very respected in his dressing room and around the NHL for the way he plays. He's a heart and soul guy. Let's be honest. He's not an 80-point guy. He's the type of guy that you can really put him on any type of line, and he can contribute. That hit was dirty, though. That was boarding, and I am surprised he wasn't kicked out of the game, and I am a little bit surprised that there wasn't a hearing, because I think you could argue that Ryan Callahan should have got one or two games for that.
Well, I'll tell you why I thought that it was a dirtier hit than a lot of the other hits. I mean, and you know, Eric sort of addressed it in that he thought that Letang turned into the hit.
By the way, is Chris Letang involved in every single hit now?
That's not a coincidence, Eddie. Well, let's be clear.
Oh, they were going after
Letang. And I was obviously tongue-in-cheek about Callahan not being relevant to yours. He's not the player he was in New York, how sure. impactful he was. The style of play that he utilizes is a factor there.
He's kind of playing that Brendan Morrow role now.
A little bit more, because when you play so hard, and he was, I mean, the guy, when those Rangers teams were competing for the Cup, heart and soul guy. Not that he's not a heart and soul guy now, but he blocked a ton of shots. He was so physical. That wears on you. And so he's not as effective as he was, but he's still an effective NHL player. But let's be clear here. I don't think he had an intention to injure Letang, but let's be honest. He knew who he was hitting, and that is, I'm sure, part of the game plan for the Tampa Bay Lightning. You put the puck into Letang's corner, and you hammer him. He's their best defenseman by a pretty considerable margin than Mata, right? And Mata's been in and out of the lineup. If you can get to Letang, either psychologically, or you can get to him physically, or both, do it. And that was part of the deal. So do I think he's going to, I can injure Letang, because it was a dirty hit, and he probably should be suspended for it. No, but I think he went in there saying, hey, game plan, I got to hit this guy hard, and probably didn't think it through well enough in terms of from behind there.
What bothered me about the hit, and I mean, you see it all the time, is that you see players turning into the hit right when they're in that danger spot right before the boards. I didn't think Letang turned into this one. I thought
that's fair. He didn't.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe I'm sounding old school here, but doesn't he, like, if you watch the play, doesn't he takes a look, sees Callahan, and doesn't prepare himself for the hit.
He doesn't prepare himself, but he also doesn't turn into it like you see so many players do when it's a bang-bang situation.
I guess it's just a different way of playing now, Drew. All the pros now,
sure,
all they do is put themselves in a position where they get hit that way. Like, if you watch, Letang turns over his right shoulder, sees Callahan, still plays the puck, places himself in the danger zone, and gets hammered. Now, that doesn't take away from the responsibility that Callahan has to play in a respectful manner. I understand that.
Yeah.
But it's just a different way than it used to be. Players used to go in on a different angle.
Absolutely. Players used to be more concerned about their own self-safety.
No. And Brian Burke would say you could bear hug the guy too into the boards, Ezzy. Another factor. Now you're just hammering him.
I also thought Andre Palat's hit on Brian Dumoulin could have been a five-minute penalty. I mean, if you watch that hit, and again...
Yeah, that was bad too.
Things happen so quickly, and you always want to say, well, you know, the guy might have turned a little bit, or he would... But Andre Palat drives Brian Dumoulin into the boards intentionally.
He was a little tighter to the boards, though, wasn't he?
He was tighter to the boards. Rich, you're right. But the point is, he needs to hold up there, right? Like, when a player is that close to the boards and you see his numbers, you cannot push him into the boards like that. So I'm actually, I think you could argue that Palat's hit on Dumoulin was actually worse.
I thought they were both dirty hits, and I am surprised that the NHL Department of Player Safety isn't looking at anything at all.
All you hear about is fighting. As we talk about, Drew, we talk about this all the time,
fighting.
Well, never mind the fighting argument for a second here. Can we not talk about the epidemic of hits from behind in the National Hockey League?
It's a good point, Rich, because I think if someone ends up breaking their neck, then the whole argument is going to be so much better supported, and the NHL is going to be forced to act, because these types of plays, something more serious could really happen. It's actually fortunate for both players that there were no injuries. And you know, speaking of injuries, Tyler Johnson did come back into the game yesterday, Drew, after getting hit knee on knee with Chris Kunitz. It's amazing how many injuries there were in one game yesterday, mm-hmm. or potential injuries. But I agree with you, Rich. I mean, hitting from behind, we've been talking about it for certainly the 7 years we've been doing this show. But you look at it at the NHL level, and you still see this type of stuff in the playoffs.
It's also interesting, if you watch John Cooper talking to the referee after that play, when they're making the call, he covers his mouth. You know, like the NFL coaches do a lot of the time, cover their mouth with their playbook.
Bill Belichick.
But I think one of the reasons he does that there is because he's probably, you know, I don't know, being critical about the call, probably saying Letang played into that, and he doesn't want his lips to be red and that to be a story. Seriously, like, I think when he's arguing that play, that's probably what he's arguing, and he probably knows.
It's possible. I mean, look, we know that John Cooper's a very smart guy, and you know that with cameras everywhere, it would be a storyline if he was to come out and say that, and then it's a war of words between him and Sullivan and everything else.
Drew, I'm a big John Cooper fan, but I don't know what he was arguing there, because that was boarding, textbook boarding. Yeah, it was very right. dirty. Right. I don't know why he didn't think that Ryan Callahan should have got 5 minutes there.
I'm sure he knows that Ryan Callahan should have got 5 minutes there, but he's got to try and defend his boys, is I'm sure what he's also saying. It's, you know, if he does nothing, you know, doing something or having a little bit of a conversation makes it seem like he's actually doing something, when in reality, you know, I can't believe he was arguing that strenuously against it. He should be lucky, thanking his lucky stars, that Callahan wasn't thrown out of that game. And I think that was an error by the officials in not eliminating Callahan from the game for that hit. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Pittsburgh perspective with Mike Colligan, our good friend. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
On the Curve, the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information about the Linden Market Dental Center, get in touch with our good friend, Dr. Les Rikus. Visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend, Mike Colligan. Mike covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. You can read his work at Forbes.com as well. Mike, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great talking to you guys.
Our pleasure to have you on, Mike. Game one defeat for the Penguins. They lose 3-1 on home ice after Tampa Bay loses goaltender Ben Bishop. He's carried off the ice on a stretcher in the first period. We were talking about this last segment. Do you think that loss on home ice is at all demoralizing for the Penguins as they enter into this Eastern Conference final?
I don't know I'd use the word demoralizing. I think it's maybe a bit of a reality check, and something that I thought would be really interesting to see how it played out coming into this series, after the Penguins having such an emotional victory over the Washington Capitals and maybe not even having a chance to really reset after that series. You know, that was just a few nights ago, and to have to turn around and play a very well-rested Tampa team on home ice, I don't think the Penguins looked ready for that game. I think Tampa looked faster. I thought Tampa looked more prepared from a coaching standpoint and a system standpoint. And I think the Penguins just came out and faced a team that was a little bit better situated for them. So I think the good thing for the Penguins is they've adapted very well. Mike Sullivan's just done a fantastic mm-hmm. job as far as coaching adjustments and really adapting throughout the second half of the season here for the Penguins. So I think that's a good thing for them. But you have to win your home games. We've seen how critical home ice can be. The Penguins will have to take advantage of game two, because they can't afford to go back to Tampa trailing them 2-0 in the series.
Mike, Matt Murray's obviously been one of the major reasons why the Pittsburgh Penguins are at this point. He's done such a fantastic job as a rookie goaltender, 21 years old, but yesterday was not one of his best games. I wouldn't say he was the reason why they lost, and some were calling for Marc-Andre Fleury to come into that game. Here's the $64,000 question. Do you turn to Marc-Andre Fleury for Game 2 when, as you mentioned, the stakes are so high?
It's a great point. You know, the later we go in this playoff series or playoff season, we're going to get more and more intense games. There's never an easy time to put a goaltender like that in. I think they're probably going to go with him in Game 2. I think, like you said, it wasn't Murray's fault last night, but certainly wasn't he shouldn't be absolved from his goals against last night as well. So I think Fleury will get that opportunity. He hasn't played in quite a long time, probably over a month and a half now, if I had to think back. And so that's a tough spot to sit there for 6 weeks and then get thrown back into playoff hockey. I think, though, early in the series is when I would do it. There was talk last series against Washington and bringing him in Game 6 or potentially a Game 7 if that's where it went. That would have been the one, if I were the Pittsburgh Penguins, that worried me a bit, because you just have no idea what you're getting. I think early in the series is the time to do it. They certainly couldn't do it for Game 1 with Murray having done so well beating the Capitals, but I think Game 2 is a great opportunity to just see what you have there and see if you can get Murray a rest a bit as well, because that's not easy. This is a mental draining playoff stretch for a lot of these goaltenders, and if you're not used to that, that can be really tough. It starts to get to you by about this third round, and we've seen some goaltenders also fall off in prior years where they've kind of carried their teams for a few rounds, and then eventually it's just too much. So I think it will be a good opportunity for them to get Fleury back in there for Game 2 in Pittsburgh.
Mike, you talked about, you know, Tampa looking more prepared, and I think there was also, you know, the kind of emotional letdown of playing against the Washington Capitals and taking them out and then playing against a Tampa team that sometimes leaves you kind of wanting for something to get motivated about. What were your thoughts? I want to go back to that series because it was such an incredible series for many reasons. But were you surprised at how the Penguins handled, I'm not saying they always deserve to win every game, but how they were able to defeat the Washington Capitals?
Yeah, I think I was. Certainly the result was very impressive. I thought the Capitals would win in probably seven games, but I thought the teams were very evenly matched, and the Penguins' speed and the Capitals' depth probably canceling each other's out, and we kind of saw that a bit. I think if you're a Washington Capitals fan, you could probably go back and think, hey, we could have won three more of those games, and they were that close, whether it was overtime or just fortunate bounces for the Penguins that were going the right way. So I think when I look back to that series, what I saw was, again, the adjustments made by Sullivan were I think really the series-changing moment. The Capitals were really aggressive on the forecheck, trying to take advantage of the Penguins' inexperienced defense, really hitting them hard with a physicality advantage that Washington had. But what that did was really open them up to kind of a second layer openings, if that makes sense. So the Penguins would send two or three forwards far up the ice. They'd have their defensemen under siege on the forecheck, but then in between would just be a significant amount of ice where if those young defensemen for Pittsburgh could just chip the puck a little bit, they could get past that first wave and then often get odd man rushes going the other way. So Washington never adapted to that over the last few games, and I think that was the speed advantage really taking over for Pittsburgh. Now, Tampa had really prepared for that last night. I saw them totally ready, taking away the middle of the ice and not getting overextended on the first two forecheckers. So that will be a challenge now for Pittsburgh to kind of readjust, think of a new way to approach some of their breakouts and try to get the odd man rush back in the game. You know, there was a couple early for Pittsburgh, and they got burned when Letang jumped into the play and Jonathan Drouin went the other way on an odd man rush and scored to grab a goal for Tampa. And you kind of saw Pittsburgh never get a chance after that. I think they really started to think twice about, hey, should we really be jumping in the play? Should we be sitting back a little bit more? And when that questioning got into their game, when they play such an aggressive style, I think that was trouble for them. So I think we'll have to see them reset a bit and rethink what their new strategy is going to be for Game 2.
Mike Colligan is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. You can read some of his work on Forbes.com as well. Mike, you know, we were talking about this earlier in the show. You know, the key to the series, from my perspective, it has to do with the depth on the Penguins' forward lines. You know, is that sort of the matchup you're really closely looking at? The, say, Hagelin, Bonino, and Kessel line, if that's quote-unquote the third line for the Penguins, how the Lightning are able to handle that third line when the Capitals weren't able to handle that line?
It's a good point. I think the depth is a really interesting question because we've been talking as if the Penguins have three really good lines, and I'm not sure that they do. I think the Kessel-Bonino line has probably been their first line, quite frankly. That's been their best line throughout the playoffs and even over the last stretch of the regular season. So that line is obviously solid all the way through, but Evgeny Malkin is on an island out there. Right now he's playing with guys like Brian Rust and Chris Kunitz who are just either too slow or just not at his talent level. And I don't think it's a surprise that you've seen Malkin hasn't scored in, I believe, 6 games. Even Sidney Crosby hasn't scored in 8 games. He's playing with guys like Connor Sheary, who were minor league forwards and have the speed to keep up with him, but they're not top line NHL players, in my opinion, yet. So I think that's a big question is while we talk about them having three lines, I don't know if they do, and I think that's going to be tough, is what do you do? Can you continue to leave Malkin on an island there where he shoots a ton of shots each game, but nothing's really too dangerous, and he's not producing offense in the playoffs here. So do you combine Crosby and Malkin and then say, hey, we're going to have two really strong lines and make Victor Hedman have to choose which one he wants to match up against and challenge some of the Tampa defensemen? But I think the depth, it will be interesting. I think the Penguins certainly have that advantage having a Kessel line in addition to Crosby and Malkin, but I think they need to think about that and make sure that that's the right approach because they need Crosby and Malkin to produce. And right now, neither of those guys are doing that. They got away with it in the Washington series, but I don't know that they can keep going through deeper and deeper into this playoff without having those two superstars putting goals in the back of the net.
Mike, you mentioned that the Pittsburgh Penguins are having all of this trouble scoring goals right now. Certainly the Kessel-Bonino line and with Carl Hagelin has been scoring goals in these playoffs. Do you expect Mike Sullivan, in addition to turning to Fleury in Game 2, do you expect him to maybe make some changes up front or on the back end to give his team a little bit of an offensive boost?
You'd think so. You'd think they'd probably get some new faces in there. That seems to be almost the superstitious thing as well, as you don't change the lineup after a win and you blow the whole thing up after a loss. I'm not a big fan of that. I think you make the changes when you need to and you make the smart and the right decisions, but certainly there's a lot that goes into it, and Fleury coming in for Murray could potentially be a really different look for the Penguins just from an emotional standpoint and getting him the opportunity to get back in there. But I think they do need to rethink that a bit and think about what they're going to do. You know, the scary thing for them that we saw early in that game was if Chris Letang is injured in any way, that just totally changes the dynamic. You know, he has played so well, and if you had to, I was thinking the other day, who is the kind of Conn Smythe player on the Penguins right now, and you could argue it was Murray through the first two rounds, but then I quickly thought, man, the impact of Letang and what he's done playing 30-plus minutes a night some of these games is huge, and when you pull him out of there, if he would get injured, that would just change the whole dynamic of this team. So that's a little bit scary, and the Penguins have to be careful in trying to keep him from just taking too much punishment, especially with his injury and concussion history. But I think they have the talent there. There's a lot of moving pieces, and there's a lot of versatile pieces for the Penguins, especially up front and on the back end with some of their offensively talented guys. They can really do a lot of different combinations. So I think you're right. Mike Sullivan will take the opportunity to kind of shake things up a bit and see if he can just throw a different look at the Tampa Bay Lightning and make them adapt for once.
Final question for you, Megan. You talk about how good Letang has been. Has there been one defenseman, you know, I looked at their defense as being a little bit of a liability coming into the playoffs, and so far so good for the Penguins. Has there been one defenseman on the back end aside from Letang that's impressed you maybe more than you expected?
It's got to be Trevor Daley. Hands down, no questions asked. Olli Maatta coming into the year, I think we'll have a great NHL career, but just with injuries and what he's had to go through, he's really, I think, borderline heading to the press box soon because of just the liabilities and the slow play that he's had right now. He's really doubting himself, and so that really was a big loss that the Penguins couldn't afford to have. They needed Mata to step up and be a really top-pairing defenseman with Letang. That was the talk for the last 2 years. If the Penguins are going anywhere, it's going to be Letang and Mata carrying them on a top pair. And with him kind of regressing a bit this season, or at least losing his confidence, and to have Trevor Daley step in like he did. And I watched him in Dallas quite a bit, as I'm sure you guys did. And fuck. He was more of a second-pair defenseman that was good offensively and almost a liability defensively. Mm-hmm. Chicago was a total disaster for him when he went there a couple years ago. And so coming into Pittsburgh, my expectations were not very high. But I think what we've seen is in a system that really emphasizes that offensive play and taking advantage of Daley's speed and side-to-side mobility, I think that's just a really big advantage for the Penguins to have that guy come in for essentially nothing. They traded him for Rob Scuderi, who was more or less an anchor on the blue line. And to have that guy come in and really be a top-pairing defenseman is probably one of the biggest and best moves for Jim Rutherford this season. So that has saved them. And I agree that the defensive depth is still a concern, though, because, as we said, if one or two of those guys gets injured, mm-hmm. you're certainly looking at a much different look on the back end there, and one that could get a little bit short if this series goes into a more physical sense, as we saw in Game 1.
Game 2 of the Pens and the Lightning goes Monday night. Mike Colligan covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. You can read his work at Forbes.com. Mike, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks for joining us, good friend.
All right. Always fun, guys. Thanks a lot.
Talk soon, Mike. Let's head to break. When we come back, some teams have new coaches. We'll talk about it next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew, Ezra, and Richard return on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
It's a great challenge. Minnesota's always been good. It's always been tough to play against. And I love the way they play, as far as the guys that they have can skate, will play an in-your-face type of game. And I just thought, overall, everything pointed in this direction.
That's new Minnesota Wild head coach Bruce Boudreau, introduced to the media earlier this week as he takes over behind the bench for the Wild. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey, and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Drew, it didn't take very long for my man Brucey to find a job.
It's true. It didn't. Bruce Boudreau hired by the Minnesota Wild quite quickly after he was dismissed by the Anaheim Ducks. And that seems to be, I think that speaks to just how well respected he is and how good of at least a regular season coach he is, in that he was fired from Washington and he was hired in Anaheim about 12 minutes right. later. And he was fired from Anaheim and he was hired in Minnesota about 12 minutes later. So Boudreau into the Central Division, is he... the Wild have, I guess they've had stability behind the bench for a while with Mike Yeo before that. So is Boudreau a good fit given the Minnesota Wild players and the system that he generally likes to play?
I think it's an odd fit.
Really? An odd fit?
Yeah.
Tell.
I'm not sold on this fit, Drew. I think this was a quick decision by Boudreau. Obviously, it's a big contract. He's got, 4 years, $12 million. So, there's a lot of reasons to accept it. You never know when you're going to get another job again. So there's a lot of factors. I don't blame Boudreau for taking the job or the Wild for offering it to him. I just don't know if this group mixes. I look at a good back end, and a goaltender had a tremendous season 2 seasons ago, but a forward group that is aging. And you look at the Anaheim Ducks and their forward group, their two guys, Perry and Getzlaf, getting a little older here, but are still more dominant than the players in Minnesota. And I know Boudreau was looking into the Parise back injury and such, but I just don't know. Look at St. Louis against San Jose in the conference finals. So you can't say they're not going to be able to make it back to make it to a lot like that level, because who knows anymore. But I just see this Minnesota team being a team that's going on the down, on the way down rather than the way up. And I think when he came to Washington, they were on the way up. And when he went to Anaheim, Bob Murray did a really good job building them on the fly. I think that Chuck Fletcher's going to have to do that. And what style is he going to play? I know this year in Anaheim, all the numbers were tremendous in terms of, well, basically every number was tremendous.
Yeah. Well, after the, you know, the first 2 months of the season.
Well, I mean, they were good on the penalty killing and the power, all that stuff. I'm not sure if that's going to be something. Like, is he going to get this team? Are they going to play a more open style? Like, is that the goal here? Because Mike Yeo was very structured. I thought too structured. So I can understand that Boudreaux is a little bit more loose with that stuff. That might make sense. But there's probably, is one of those things where there's probably also a reason that Yeo was structured, and it was because of some of the, you know, maybe the lack of speed up front and the lack of physicality up front, aside from guys like Niederreiter. So I don't know if Boudreaux's style will mesh necessarily with this Wild team. I'm probably in the minority there. I just have some questions about it.
Richie, do you know that Bruce Boudreaux taught Paul Newman how to take a slap shot?
It's true. Is that actually true?
Yeah, it's true. You can look it up. It's just an interesting tidbit.
Where did that come from?
Well, it was written about him when he was hired by the Minnesota Wild, because he started his pro hockey career playing for the Minnesota Fighting Saints.
Yeah.
And there was a famous story about how he taught Paul Newman before the filming of Slapshot on how to actually take Slapshot.
I did not know that. I'll tell you what, the research you do to prepare for this show is second to absolutely none.
Oh, I can research.
You can research. You can certainly research. So, Ezzy, your thoughts on the Boudreaux hire?
To Richie's point,
yes,
I think it is an interesting hire. Not surprising. I mean, guys, we knew that Bruce Boudreaux had a good chance of being hired as a head coach. I mean, he's been a head coach many years. The fit, it remains to be seen, Richie, and I agree with you. I think that there needs to be moves made on this team. And heading into this season, so last year's offseason, with the exception of Mike Riley, the Wild didn't make any moves. The roster that the Minnesota Wild had this year was exactly the same. And it's been proven that this roster is flawed. It's not a fast enough team. Rich has talked about that quite a bit. Mm-hmm. There's not the right mix on this team. You know, Devin Dubnyk had a pretty good season, but do you need to maybe bring someone in to challenge Devin Dubnyk a little bit? I realize that he's under contract long term, but really he didn't have a push from anybody in the system.
Maybe not even to challenge him, but to take some of the pressure, take some of the weight off him.
Right.
He played 67 games this past season.
And it's a good point, Drew, because if you look at Devin Dubnyk's career prior to last season, mm-hmm. Devin Dubnyk was always really in a backup role. Yeah. So maybe he's better suited to play 40 or 50 games, maybe have a type of Dallas split with Niemi and Lehtinen, even though that didn't really work out for the Dallas
Hopefully
Stars.
Hopefully with better goaltenders, though.
Well, but the point is, nowadays, you know, the really good teams have a 1A and a 1B goalie. Look at Tampa Bay, Andrei Vasilevsky. He might only be 21 years old, but he can step right into the lineup, and he doesn't miss a beat. Matt Murray steps into the lineup for Marc-Andre Fleury and Jeff Zadkov. He was pretty good, so you have to have a prospect in the system, Connor Hellebuck, mm-hmm. with the Jets. So I think the Minnesota Wild don't really have that goaltending prospect right now, so that's an issue. But, you know, Chuck Fletcher right now, Rich, he has to make some moves. I mean, you can't have Thomas Vanek making whatever he makes, $6 million, a healthy scratch. I mean, he's basically dead weight on this team. Jason Pominville had a bad year. I mean, Zach Parise, Mikko Koivu, this is still the core of your team. And then guys like Granlund, and Richie mentioned a guy like Nino Niederreiter, Jason Zucker, these types of guys. This is the younger core of the team. But you have to look at this team and you have to say, okay, well, where are we strong and where do we need to improve? And they're strong on defense, even though guys like Mike Riley and Matt Dumba, rookies, well, I guess Dumba's in his second year now, but young defensemen, they've struggled a little bit. Is there a little bit too much pressure on Ryan Suter, who I thought had an excellent season, had a career year offensively, but it's not the right mix here. So, again, getting back to Bruce Boudreaux, I mean, we know he's an excellent coach. He was an excellent coach with Washington, mm-hmm. even though he struggled at times dealing with all the stars like Ovechkin. But in Anaheim, he just can't get over that Game 7 hurdle, Rich. And Boudreaux's had success at every level. He's had the success at the American Hockey League level. And you look at this Ducks team, and Getzlaff, Perry, these guys struggled earlier in the season. And then the Anaheim Ducks were one of the hottest teams in the Western Conference, winning the division. And then what happens? Again, they struggle and they can't get out of the first round of the playoffs. So he has that as his Achilles heel right now. That's going to follow Bruce Boudreau around. Now, this Wild team, you also have to ask, well, is the window closing on this team? Is this team even going to be a playoff team next year? Because I look at the Central Division, I look at our Winnipeg Jets, and I think if there's any team in the Central Division that the Jets can beat out that was in the playoffs this year, it's probably the Wild. I don't think the Wild were that much better than the Jets this year. I realize the Jets really struggled on special teams and all of that, but I think Boudreau is almost walking into a very unfamiliar situation, Rich, at the NHL level. Because you're right, in Anaheim, you had Getzlaff and Perry, and he kind of let those stars run the dressing room, run kind of do whatever they wanted to do, a little bit more of a free-flowing style, whereas Mike Yeo was a lot more structured, as Rich mentioned. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here, because once you throw in all of the moves that need to be made, then I think we're really going to see what the expectations are going to be for this team.
But you talk about the free-flowing style and Yeo being more structured. I mean, the Ducks had the best goals against...
That's what I'm saying. They had all the numbers that made sense.
Right.
They were great in every aspect. Did that translate to the first round?
No.
I mean, don't get me wrong. They played well in Game 7, in Ottawa, won Game 7, but I don't think it necessarily translated all to the first round. So... I'm not saying that Boudreau's not capable of having his team buy into it. I'm just wondering, this roster needs turnover.
Yep.
To me. Some turnover. It doesn't need to have 30 moves, but needs some turnover.
Sure.
To get younger up front.
Yeah.
And is Boudreau going to be, like, coaches' shelf lives aren't, coaches, you know, a guy's shelf life isn't very long. Like, is he going to be moving this team through that? And is his record then going to be a reflection of maybe a team in transition? Or are they going to try and get as much as they can out of this group? So I think that's a stretch. Don't get me wrong. I think you can get a little bit more out of this group for sure. Better performances up front and stuff. But I think there's a ceiling there.
Yep. I agree with that.
So I think that the job is a little bit more limited to me. That's all.
And you don't really, and just quickly here, Drew, I mean, I think the Minnesota Wild are one of those teams. I think they're kind of at a similar stage as the Ottawa Senators, as far as like they're a team that they can make the playoffs. They could easily miss the playoffs, but if they get to the playoffs, you don't really expect much out of them, and they don't really have a dominant first line. They have an excellent number one defenseman.
Biggest
the goaltending is good, but it's not they're not really excellent in any area.
Sens are younger and have less big-time salary commitments.
Yeah, but when you look at the Wild, too, with like the future core of the team with Coyle and Zucker and Niederreiter and Halla, and then on defense with Dumba and Riley, they're getting younger, right, Rich? And they're going to bring in some other players.
I think the question is, can those players take another? Is there another level for those young players you just mentioned to go to?
Get rid of Vanek.
It's not just Vanek, right? It's Vanek, and you have Pominville, and you have Koivu, and you have Preeti. I mean, your core guys are getting older.
Well, the question is, and they can San Jose with Couture and Pavelski. Do Coyle and Granlund have another level to go up to, and they can see a shift in the transition in that way where Thornton and Marlowe can sort of take a step back and be more complementary players?
The only problem with that
is
that, with due respect to the veterans you spoke about in the Minnesota Wild, they're not Thornton and Marlowe.
They're not. And that's I think, speaks to your point about how this job might not be as appealing as Bruce Boudreau makes it out to seem to jump on it as quickly as he did.
Again, but there are only 30 jobs.
And
you get left out for a couple of years, and then it's hard to get back in. Look at Mark Crawford. Right?
And so, a bird in the hand is worth worth two in the bush. Let's go to break. We didn't get to the Senators coaching thing. We'll try and get to that later on in the show. Lots to talk about when we come back. Andy Strickland joins us from Fox Sports Midwest to talk about the Blues ahead of the Western Conference Finals. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew, Ezra, and Richard return on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys is known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personalized, visit Keener Jerseys online at KeenerJerseys.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program Andy Strickland. Andy covers the St. Louis Blues for Fox Sports Midwest. Andy, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime, guys. How are you this morning?
Doing very well, Andy. Thanks very much. Obviously, we brought you on to talk about the Western Conference Finals. They get underway tomorrow night in St. Louis as the Sharks and the Blues will do battle to see who represents the Western Conference in the Stanley Cup Finals. You know, it took seven games, but the Blues were able to dispatch the Dallas Stars. Was that series not as close as a seven-game series would make it out to be? From my perspective, just, you know, watching on TV and from an outsider's point of view, the Blues were the better of the two teams, really, throughout that series, throughout the majority of that series.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I mean, I was a little bit surprised that it went the distance, went to seven games when you look at how some of the games played out. I mean, you look at game one when Dallas was able to win that one at home. You know, St. Louis maybe still dealing with a little bit of the Chicago Blackhawks hangover. A lot of excitement about winning that series, and it took a little while for St. Louis to kind of get their game going and to become engaged emotionally in that game. And, you know, they lost that one. They lost the game at home in overtime, which they probably should have won as well. So, no, I would agree, you know, a couple of blowout victories. You know, you got the 5-1 Game 7 victory. There was a 6-1 win in there as well. So I think if you look at, you know, beginning to end, and start to finish, there's no question St. Louis was the better team, but you got to give Dallas credit. They found a way to hang in there, and again, their inconsistent goaltending, I think, is what did them in. They just couldn't get the consistent goaltending and couldn't get the timely save, something St. Louis did get, and obviously a big reason as to why they're moving on.
Andy, for you, for the St. Louis Blues, heading into this series, tomorrow night's game one especially, what's the key matchup here? Is it shutting down Joe Pavelski and Logan Couture, or do you look at it like the San Jose Sharks have to figure out a way to shut down Robbie Fabry, Paul Stastny, and Troy Brouwer? Sorry, I got to get the right Stastny here.
Yeah, Peter Stastny will be there, by the way. I don't think he'll be in uniform, but he can still play. Believe me, watching him play with some of the Blues alumni. So, no, I think both teams have to worry about players on the other side in terms of how they want to match things up and who they want to shut down. I mean, you didn't even mention Vladimir Tarasenko, who is, you know, a 40-goal scorer over the course of the regular season. But you're right. You know, the Stastny-Fabry line really isn't strong. Really going back to the final month, 6 weeks of the regular season when Ken Hitchcock put them together. I mean, they just, you know, all three kind of bring something different to the table. But they're all, you know, pretty responsible defensively, especially Brouwer and Stastny in terms of, you know, their experience, but offensively, Robbie Fabry is what kind of makes that line go. You know, Ken Hitchcock has used different players on that line here in the playoffs when he's moved Fabry down, and they just have him look the same. I think Fabry, in terms of the pace that he plays with, makes those guys play quicker, makes those guys certainly look quicker, and they create offensive opportunities and chances at a higher rate with Robbie Fabry on that line. So I think San Jose is certainly going to have to be aware of them. But the Blues are going to need more than just one line. We know that. Yuri Lehterä, I think, got better in Game 7. Vladimir Tarasenko is going to have to find that groove consistently, and it's not easy. I mean, you watch the Stanley Cup playoffs, often you see the top players get canceled out because the checking is so tight. And I don't think Vladimir Tarasenko has ever seen or experienced this level of checking in his hockey career. So it's a little bit different, and you hope from that experience over the course of the first two rounds that he's going to be able to, you know, find that next gear, find some open ice, and still come through offensively for this team. But David Backes has had a really good series. You know, Patrick Berglund, who Backes is playing with, is probably playing the best hockey we've ever seen from him. I mean, just in terms of the pace he's playing with, how he's playing through contact, he's getting chances, he's winning faceoffs. He leads the Blues in plus-minus. He's a plus-9 player thus far in the playoffs. You know, Backes has 6 goals in the playoffs. So the Blues have gotten goals from 15 different players thus far in the playoffs. So, again, the balance scoring, the spread-out scoring, I think is a big reason as to why they're still playing, and they're going to need that moving forward.
Andy, if you take a step back, say, about a year and a half ago, and you were to say, oh, you know, Brian Elliott's going to lead the Blues to the conference finals with a chance to go to the cup, and would have been a lot of skepticism. There was a point where now an executive with the team, Marty Brodeur, was brought in, and Jake Allen was seen as the next guy. Are you surprised that he's come through and been just so good through these first two rounds?
Well, I'd lie to you if I said I wasn't, to be honest with you. Now, I got to answer this question a couple of different ways. Am I surprised that Brian Elliott has led this team to the conference finals after the season that he had and after the second half that he had? No. But if you would have told me last summer that he'd be the guy to lead this team to the Western Conference finals, I probably wouldn't have believed it, just because Jake Allen was expected to be that player. And, mm-hmm. you know, Jake Allen was sensational. People forget how good this guy was the first half of the season. Probably should have made the All-Star team if the selection, you know, situation right now with the All-Star game wasn't so crazy. You know, he probably, you know, would have found his way on the roster. He was unreal in the first half, probably their MVP along with Tarasenko. And then he went down with his injury. And once he went down with an injury, you know, Brian Elliott just kind of took off. And you go back to the middle of January when the Blues had a game in St. Louis against Montreal. And I think Brian Elliott recorded a 47-save shutout in that game. It was also Heritage Night. The Blues do a couple of these different Heritage Nights, and it was, you know, recognizing the best goaltenders in Blues history, and Curtis Joseph was on hand, Grant Fear was on hand, there was a number of guys who were there. And, you know, Brian Elliott played at the University of Wisconsin like Curtis Joseph. Joseph was his hero growing up, and they're both from the same hometown. And at that time, Brian Elliott brought off these replica throwback Curtis Joseph pads with the all blue pads and the exact mask that Curtis Joseph wore back in the early 90s
yeah.
for the St. Louis Blues. And the idea was to wear it just for one game. Well, he got a shutout in that game with Curtis Joseph in the building, and he was the first Blue since Curtis Joseph to have a shutout in a game that with at least 47 saves. I mean, it was just crazy. Well, he's never taken the mask off, and he hasn't taken the pads off either, and he's gone on to have a career year and just played the best hockey he's ever played in his entire life, and here he is in the Western Conference Finals, still at the Blues starting goaltender, still wearing the Curtis Joseph pads. So there's something crazy about that when you go back and think about that night and where we are today. So this is truly a magical time for Brian Elliott in a number of different ways. And again, I think he surprised a lot of people. But at this stage, I think people just realize this guy's a really good goaltender, and I don't think there will be any surprises from this point moving forward if he's able to get this team into the Stanley Cup final.
Andy Strickland is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He covers the St. Louis Blues for Fox Sports Midwest. Andy, given everything you just said about Brian Elliott, and that's a really interesting story about the pads and the mask with Curtis Joseph in attendance, how seriously do you think Ken Hitchcock considered going to Jake Allen in Game 7 of the previous series?
I don't think he really considered it. I think deep down maybe there was some thought about it. Because, listen, Ken Hitchcock knows Jake Allen is a great goaltender. And I don't think anybody believes that Jake Allen couldn't have started that game and won the game. I mean, you look at the, you know, the way that he was played, obviously, you know, scoring five goals. But still, it was Brian Elliott's confidence that he gave the team, I think, early on in that game. You know, Dallas had a number of chances offensively, and he was able to shut the door and make some saves. And I think the team kind of fed off that confidence, you know, up until they got a power play chance, and Robbie Fabry was able to score the first goal of the game, you know. But, you know, maybe there was some, like, discussion internally, but I don't think there was ever any real serious thought. I think there was maybe a little bit of gamesmanship that Ken Hitchcock was playing with the media. But it's not like Brian, and I've said this numerous times, what happens in the media versus what happens internally, we all know. A lot of times it was completely different. And it's not like Brian Elliott went to bed that night prior to Game 7, not knowing if he was going to start mm-hmm. the next day. He knew that he, you know, the net was going to be his on Game 7. He woke up knowing the net was his for that Game 7. So I don't think there was ever really any serious consideration. And I think the best thing that maybe happened to Brian Elliott was the fact that he didn't have to play all of Game 6, and he was able to rest. I mean, that was like his 15th or 16th or 17th consecutive start going back to the quarter to the regular season. And that's difficult for a lot of goaltenders in the National Hockey League to have to, you know, be relied upon to play, you know, that much hockey and start, you know, that many games in a row. That's not easy. And so maybe he needed a little bit of a mental breather as well as a physical breather just to regroup, because he looked pretty sharp, obviously, in Game 7.
Andy, for me, watching the St. Louis Blues in the first round versus the Chicago Blackhawks and in the second round versus the Dallas Stars, I thought Alex Pietrangelo was the best defenseman on either team in both rounds. He's only got 8 points, but he plays 29, 30, sometimes more than 30 minutes a game. Do you think this is the highest level you've ever seen Alex Pietrangelo play at?
Probably. Although, see, this is the problem with the Blues in recent years, with the inability to advance deep into the playoffs, because we haven't been able to appreciate certain players, like an Alex Pietrangelo. I mean, this guy was really, really good last year in the first round against Minnesota, but now they're able to get deep in the playoffs, and I think the whole hockey world is able to see the level of game that he's able to bring, you know, and obviously the deeper you get to the playoffs, the harder the game becomes, the more you rely on players like him, just like Chicago has with Duncan Keith the last few years. Drew Doughty, obviously, in L.A. I mean, there's certain players that, you know, have that ability to raise their level. And Alex Pietrangelo has proven to be one of those guys. You know, he doesn't put up the offensive numbers that maybe some of those guys do. Maybe isn't as dangerous offensively or with the puck. But there's nothing wrong with being able to defend at a real high level. And sometimes we lose sight of that in terms of where the National Hockey League is today. This guy is a great, not a good, but a great one-on-one defender, a great penalty killer. Incredibly intelligent, with the puck, at the puck, so smart, so cerebral in terms of how he plays the game, and I think now we're able to appreciate that. He could probably put up better offensive numbers if he had maybe a little bit of a different role. You have guys like Kevin Shattenkirk who are here. Alexander Steen plays the point on that first power play unit with Shattenkirk, so the Pietrangelo and Parayko are sometimes getting that second unit duty. But in terms of his ability to shut down the opposition's top players, and we're talking Jonathan Toews, Patrick Kane. I mean, those guys did absolutely nothing for the most part from a goal scoring standpoint in the first round. And they got, you know, I think they had, you know, 13 assists combined, but it's still only one goal between the two. And then you look at in round two, Jamie Benn scores one goal, and there's no question Dallas missed Tyler Seguin, but Alex Pietrangelo has a lot to do with that. A lot of Jay Bouwmeester, who's his partner, plays a lot for the St. Louis Blues as well.
Andy, in this day and age, you don't see as many, you know, hear about speeches that coaches make. You know, it's more of a movie thing now. But it came out after the game 7 that Ken Hitchcock did give his team a speech about just how difficult it is to make it to the conference finals and how few opportunities you have. And he's had really since the beginning of his career when he was able to win a cup early on with Dallas. Can you talk about that and what the players' reaction was?
Well, the players' reaction was very positive. You know, Ken Hitchcock, you know, this is where he comes in handy for this organization and for the Blues. Because you look at the group of players outside of Troy Brouwer, very few have been in this position ever, right? But Ken Hitchcock has, several times over. And he's also way more relaxed probably at this stage of his life and at this stage of his career than maybe he was before. You know, he talked about, you know, when he was in Dallas, he took it for granted. He's not doing that this time around. This is the best job Ken Hitchcock has done flat out since he's come to St. Louis. When you consider all the adversity this team faced from an injury standpoint during the course of the regular season, losing their best players, a number of them, from Schwartz to Steen, you know, Paul Stastny, Kevin Shattenkirk, I mean, Alex Pietrangelo, these guys all missed about 9-10 games or more. In the case of Berglund or Schwartz or Steen, you know, Berglund or Schwartz missed close to 50 games. Steen missed, you know, north of 10 games as well. So, again, the fact that they were able to stay afloat and really challenge Dallas for the division crown in the toughest division in the league really says something about the job that he did. But, you know, this guy knows how to handle this situation. He's perfect with the media. And I think for a guy who has a reputation of being tight and being, you know, way too serious, you know, he keeps it pretty loose internally with the players. And this is the players' time. I think he recognizes that. He understands that. And this is a veteran group, even though, you know, people may not consider them a veteran group. But these, you know, this core group of players has been together for quite a while. You look at bringing over guys like Upshaw and Brodziak and Brouwer. These guys are veteran players as well. I know you have the three rookies, you know, with Fabry, Parayko, and Edmondson. And I think that's why this team is different compared to the years past. I think that combination of youth and experience really has the making of this team unlike any other team we've seen in recent history with the Blues. But I think Ken Hitchcock, his ability to keep things loose, to motivate his team, and there's no question that speech that he gave the players certainly resonated with them, and allow them to break things after a disappointing Game 6 loss.
One more question quickly, Andy. You know, the Rams have obviously left. It's early in the baseball season. No pro basketball in town. Are the Blues capturing the imagination of the fan base there?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, this is the most enthusiasm for this hockey club around the city that I've ever seen, to be honest with you. This is my 17th year covering the NHL here in St. Louis, and my first year, they won the President's Trophy in 99-2000. When they lost to the Sharks in seven games, if you guys remember, I don't know how old you are, but Owen Nolan scored for the Red Line, mm-hmm. on the turf.
Yep.
He still haunts Blues fans to this day, Owen Nolan's Game 7 goal against Rowan Turek from the Red Line. But, you know, the fan base was pretty energetic at that point in time because the team was so good all year. And they had the MVP in Chris Pronger, the Norris Trophy winner in Chris Pronger, the Jack Adams winner in Joel Quenneville at the time. So, you know, Al McInnes, all these guys were playing for the team. They really felt like they had a strong chance, but they lost in the first round. So that was a complete buzzkill this time around. The fact that they were able to beat Chicago in the first round, their rival, their nemesis from the last few years, I think goes a long way as well. If they would have played, say, Winnipeg or Minnesota in the first round, there still would have been a ton of excitement, but probably not to the level or the value that we saw by beating the Chicago Blackhawks. So there's no doubt. People are into it, and a lot of it had to do with the football team leaving. People were pretty down. I mean, just in terms of how that situation went down, it was difficult for fans to take here in St. Louis. So the fact that they were able to get past Chicago, now here in the Western Conference Finals, the Cardinals are struggling, the Rams are gone. This is perfect timing for this community.
Andy Strickland covers the St. Louis Blues for Fox Sports Midwest. Game one between the Sharks and the Blues goes tomorrow evening. Andy, really appreciate your time and insight. Thanks for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Anytime, guys. You guys have a great day.
You too, Andy. Thanks very much. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll give our analysis on the Blues and the Sharks. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.